For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
I'm going to talk about church planting for a little while, and a little more of a dialogue, and we're going to do some Q&A, things of that sort, rather than a message. I want you to look to Luke chapter 10. You got a Bible, take it out, Luke chapter 10. And here's the thing, it's funny, just to give you full disclosure, I'm often asked to preach on church planting. And because that's how I kind of started. I'll give you a little bit of my story. My first church I planted in the inner city of Buffalo, New York, among the urban poor, and when I was 21 years of age, that was 24 years ago, my wife and I, we felt the call of the Lord. I had my undergraduate degree in biology and chemistry with a pre-med focus. About to take the MCAT, everything else, and the Lord redirected us. And without any theological training, we moved to the inner city of Buffalo, New York, and we planted a church. And it was a great experience, and also one of the most challenging experiences of our lives. Buffalo was the fastest shrinking city in America at that time. Every couple of years it gets, and Buffalo has never recovered from the recession of the 1970s. And as a matter of fact, the mayor, Jimmy Griffin, they call him Six Pack Jimmy, and it wasn't because of his workout regimen. He asked, I met him when he came and said, what are you moving to the city for when everyone else is evacuating the city? So that's where we started. We started by planting a church among the urban poor, a multicultural church, but multicultural not because we were all cool and wanted to relate to each other over lattes. It was multicultural because we were all poor and no one could get out of the city and they were trapped there. So they had to go to church together. And so started a church there and started a church in Erie, Pennsylvania. We actually started some daughter churches out of those as well. Our churches multiplied. Started three churches in Erie, Pennsylvania, one church and planted two daughter churches. Then we moved to, I was a seminary professor for 3 years. In Louisville, Kentucky, and I found out I was not a very wired to be a seminary professor. And then I since have been doing research in missiology. I did my education after I moved to Buffalo and started planting churches. So my life has been, when I was in Louisville, I did Church Evangelization Project, and I got very passionate about that. I've written a few books on church evangelization, but then I planted a church in Atlanta, and now I'm planting a church in Tennessee. Now, the obvious question people often ask me, why are you planting a church in Tennessee? Because, I mean, I'm kind of a motivational speaker who lives in a van down by the river. And so I sort of fly around. I kind of persecute pastors and encourage church leaders all over the country. And so why plant a church? Well, part of the reason is I really, really, really believe in church planting. It costs me personally to be involved in church planting. If I go preach at other people's churches, this is probably I'm not telling you a secret. When you go preach at someone's church, they give you money for it. It's kind of awesome. And when I preach at my church, I give money to actually preach at my church. And so I gave up income, gave up time, et cetera, et cetera. But here's why. I've got three daughters and one awesome wife. And my wife, Donna, is her name, and she's awesome. And I have Kristen, 14, Jacqueline, 10, and Caitlin, 7. There is no place I would rather have them than in a vibrant congregation that's reaching the lost, engaging our community, living on mission. And so, before that, I was the interim pastor of a church of a 9,000-member interim pastor, which is great fun. It's great fun. You go in, all you see is lights. They have a green room. Everyone calls you respectful names. It's sort of fun to do, and it's still fun. I mean, I go once a month, I go preach at somebody else's church. So I just preached at James River Assembly of God in Springfield on Sunday. Great church. I don't know, 8,000-9,000 people. You basically see lights and, big stage, great worship, all kind of stuff. But then Sunday, I'll be back at my church. We got about 200 people. And there's this lady in the second row keeps talking to me during the middle of the sermon for some reason that I can't figure out. And I got this other person up there who doesn't realize that a crying baby can be very distracting. Well, she's fine. She'll stop. Yeah, 30 minutes from now, she'll stop. So I think it, for me, being involved in a new church plant, starting a new church, it's probably the most important ministry thing I'm doing right now. No offense to you. Because to me, I can talk about mission. I can talk about ministry. But to me, it's much more important that I'm actually doing it. So, now to be fair, as a lead pastor who basically works for the church, puts about 10 to 15 hours a week into church life, I'm not doing all that that a full-time pastor would be doing. But there are three things I do. I prepare the messages every week. Exactly. Does this happen a lot? Just random people come up on the stage? I've read Xenos. I mean, there's a whole webpage like why we're strange, which I think is just awesome that you would put a webpage up why we're strange, because that saves so many questions. And it's like, yeah, you were a little weird. Yeah, not so much. No. Anyway, moving on. I'm just afraid where he's going to come out and. I forgot what I was saying. I got three things I do. I prepare the messages, three quarters of the time I preach, and then one quarter of the time I preach somebody else's church. And then I meet the staff. We meet at 6 a.m. or 6:30 a.m. on Mondays and Thursdays typically, so because we got to meet before work. So two of our staff are vocationally employed elsewhere outside the church. Two of them are vocationally employed inside the church. And so we meet at 6:30 a.m. on Mondays and Thursdays. 6:30 a.m. staff meeting. Let that sink in, pastors. Enjoy that awesome moment. And oftentimes we do it on an elliptical because we want to exercise. And so it's kind of we jointly exercise together. I know what you're thinking. You're not doing it right, but I'm better. I'm trying. But the third thing I do is I lead a life group in my neighborhood. And as I zero down, all right, so why am I pastoring? Because God's called me to. I fall in love with the people that God's called us to reach. We're reaching our community. But also because I don't think I should be talking about what I'm not doing. But the most important thing that I'm doing is not preaching on Sunday. But important thing, I might see it, is what I'm doing on Sunday night when my neighbors meet in my home. There's eight neighbors within two houses of my house, you know, immediate next door. Of the eight neighbors within two houses of my house, only one of them have not come to small group or church. And several of them are new believers that now started being engaged in our Christian community. Rededicated a couple of new Christians, and we have one family that's coming every week now, who live just right behind me to this one side, who this is their first time in church in their whole lives, but they come in several weeks just asking questions and doing this stuff. To me, I want you to hear this, to me, that is the most important part of my ministry every week. And the reason why is I think that's where God has called me and you to be agents of God's mission and community. Now, I want to talk about church planting through that lens and through that context, and I'm going to be a little better about giving you time for questions. It's 10:30. I'm supposed to go, I think, till 11:30. Does that include questions, or does somebody know? What time am I supposed to be done that with? Oh, you check, and I'll start. Well, you just check when you find out. Let me know. Turn your Bibles to Luke chapter 10. Luke chapter 10. So I'm often asked to speak on church planting, and there's no church planting passage. There's missions passages. There's going passages. But to me, I love the result of what they did in Luke chapter 10 was the creating of congregations. And so I want to look at that. I want to look at the teachings of Jesus. He said, I will build my church. And then he sent out people to do certain things as he builds his church. And so I want to look at Luke chapter 10 to give us a picture of that. And Luke chapter 10, beginning at verse 1.
This session goes till noon.
Till noon. This session goes till noon. Really? It's like a party. All right. Buckle in, folks. We're ready to go. Luke chapter 10, beginning of verse 1, says this. Now, I'll actually just read the first part, and then we'll go through the rest as we go. It says, after this, the Lord appointed 70 others, and he sent them ahead of him in pairs to every town and place where he himself was about to go. He told them, the harvest is abundant, but the workers are few. Therefore, pray to the Lord of the harvest to send out workers into the harvest. Now go, I'm sending you out like lambs among wolves, which is kind of a fascinating phrase in and of itself. So what I want to do is I want to look at four things kind of through this text, and I want to talk some about my church planting experience and the research on church planting. I think it's probably fair to say that at Lifeway Research, we've done more research on North American church planting than anyone else has done. So we can, I think, kind of talk about some of these things from research perspective. Number one is, if you're taking notes, begin with radical reliance. Begin with radical reliance. And that's verse 4. It says, don't carry a money bag, a travel bag, or sandals. Don't greet anyone along the road. It's kind of interesting. So Jesus sends them out, and we're going to see this whole passage, the sending out. Don't carry a money bag, a travel bag, or sandals. Don't greet anyone along the road. Now, here's what we found after 2,000 years of mission history. We have found that money is probably the most common cause that kills a movement of church planting. And it's kind of interesting because I know that sounds it sounds overstated, but it's not. We have found that when around the world, around the globe, people get dependent on money to plant churches, they stop planting churches. And I want you to hear this. You can never buy your way into a church planting movement. You can never buy your way into a church planting movement. We've actually seen, I mentioned the last church planting movement we saw was on was 1795 to 1810 on what was called the Western Frontier. But there have been what we call church multiplication movements. In the book, Viral Churches, that Warren Bird and I wrote together, we did a study to see where was really great multiplication happening? Where do we see that multiplication occurring? And what we found was there were some movements not that long ago where there was great multiplication. For example, some of you are old enough in this room to remember the heyday of the Vineyard. So you're involved in the Vineyard, or you just love the Vineyard?
Yes,
both. All right, good. How many of you know what I'm talking about with the Vineyard? You know the Vineyard churches? Okay. Of course, you have Rich Nathan is in Columbus, and Rich is a friend of mine. I just recently hosted all the Vineyard large megachurch pastors, I guess they call them, in my office there in Nashville. Not my office, but in our meeting rooms near our office. And we did a couple-day session together on missional ministry. How can megachurches be intentionally more missional? And if you know the Vineyard is, it's the good people, love the Lord, but not the movemental growth that they used to have. There was a time, you know, the Vineyard actually has some organizational history before this, but most would trace the key moment in Mother's Day 1980 when a guy named Lonnie Frisbee was preaching, and he wouldn't get mentioned a lot later on because of some issues in his own life, but Lonnie Frisbee was preaching. They would describe kind of the supernatural outpouring that launched on Mother's Day 1980, that launched what would become the Vineyard. And what was remarkable about the Vineyard is how quickly people engaged in church planting as a normative practice of the movement. And what you had is you had several others too. You had Calvary Chapel, you had the Hope Bible Stand movement, and really in some ways the original Zenos folks were influenced by some of these conversations as well. And so you have this, Donald Miller, not the cool Donald Miller who wrote Blue Like Jazz, but the scholar Donald Miller, wrote a book called Reinventing American Protestantism and talks a lot about the Vineyard, Calvary Chapel, Hope Chapel movements. And so they kind of exploded out. Well, at one point, the number of Vineyard churches was growing by 100% each year, close to 100% each year, not exactly 100%. Here's why. So Johnny Crist is a friend of mine in Atlanta. He planted the Atlanta Vineyard. And I asked him, I said, in 1982, I said, how did this happen? What happened? He said, well, John Wimber had a word. And if you're not Pentecostal, you don't know how to do that, but I can explain. Having a word is having a prompting of the Holy Spirit and explaining to somebody. So John Wimber had a word and said to Johnny Crist, man, you should go to Atlanta and plant a church. And he was like, yes, I'll go to Atlanta and plant a church. And that's what happened is there was these explosion of church plants that just went out. People started planting churches, and they did it with radical reliance. Because, and you know what it says here, you know, don't carry money bag, trail bag, sandals, don't greet anyone along the road. Well, what happened is because it was a kind of a new movement with new emphases, you know, kind of birthed out of a time. People were talking a lot more about signs and wonders, a distinctively charismatic movement. I'm not in the charismatic movement, but I so appreciate a lot of what God does there. So they went out and they just did it. They didn't wait to ask for permission. This is a pattern when we see movements, is that people are given permission but not paid to plant churches. Let me say it again. People are given permission, but not often paid to plant churches. Now, I'm for paying to plant churches. Don't misunderstand. I'm going to talk about that a little bit later as we go through here. But what I want to say to you is that movements are not birthed through money. Movements are not birthed through money. I mentioned earlier the 1795 to 1810 movement in my main session that kind of exploded into the Western frontier, and it was Baptists and Methodists, and they competed with each other, very friendly competition. They were much more similar than they were different. You know, evangelicals were evangelicals, and they weren't, you know, mainliners and all these other issues. So they were just out on the frontier, and the Methodists would kind of march by the Baptist church that was planted, which might be meeting in some other facility, someone's house or something, and they'd be singing, we're starting two a day, because the Methodists at that time were starting two churches a day. We're starting two a day, and they'd sing that, and the Baptists would joke about the Methodists. They'd say, oh, Indiana, there's nothing in Indiana but Methodists and crows, because the Methodists would go out and start church, all these little towns, all these little places. And what was remarkable was what happened was they just gave people permission. William Warren Sweet is a very famous historian, and he explained this way. He called it the Baptist farmer preacher. Now, everyone was a farmer back then, so it's not just you have to be a farmer, but he would farm all week long, and then Saturday night they'd have kind of a business meeting at the church. They actually have a weekly business meeting at the church where they kind of check each other's testimony, hold each other accountable. They'd actually like ask, does anybody know of any sin that we need to be talking about here as a church tonight? And which got to be an awesome kind of moment just to be there. I'm like, I'll stay for this, and just to see. But they called each other, very high accountability, and then Sunday morning, the Baptist farm preacher would preach, and then he'd go back to plowing on Monday. And so, but again, they didn't know any better. That's what they thought they were supposed to do. The Methodists had a different polity. The Methodists believed, they're really closer to Anglicans at the time. They believed that they needed a priest, a pastor, to do certain functions over the elements, like the bread and the cup. And so they couldn't, every little Methodist place couldn't have its own pastor. So what happened was they created this thing called the class leader, which was just like the Baptist farmer preacher. And so Methodists had the class leader, the Baptists had the Baptist farmer preacher. So the Methodists would have the class leader, and the class leader would go out and would start this church. And then once in a while, this guy would ride by in his horse, sort of bless the stuff that needed to be blessed and kind of go on. And I bet you know what that person who ride by was called. What was that person called? Circuit rider, sure. That's the circuit rider. By the way, the average circuit rider died at the age of 39, just exhausted. Just did this. So same systems, right? Now here's the thing I want you to see. There was an Anglican bishop that once asked a Baptist leader in Rhode Island, "Why are you Baptists planting all these churches on the frontier?" And here's what the Baptist said to the Anglican. Said, "Because we don't wait to ask for permission." If you're going to see a movement, you're going to begin with radical reliance that has a permission-giving structure that is not dependent on finances. Now, let's talk about finances. Are finances bad? No, they're not bad. I've planted churches with no money. I've planted churches with little money. I never planted churches with a lot of money. That would be cool. But so far, no one has decided to give me any money for that. But here's the thing. There'll never be enough money for you to have. And what we found is we did a study of... I used to work at an agency, and I ran I actually had the largest single budget for church planting in the United States of any denomination of any kind. I had $3.5 million a year I could spend on church planting, and I sent out 122 church planters in the last year that I was there, funded church planters who were seminary graduates. We compared, so we funded them not a lot. We wanted to keep them poor so they stay relying on Jesus, and we were successful at that for sure. So our typical church planter made $35, $40, raised other funds. And well, we started another program in our agency that had another name, but it basically the idea was a large church plant thing. So we got a really big mega church to fund half of it, and then our agency kicked in half. So we kicked in, it was $250,000 from the really big honking mega church that's going to start a really big honking mega church. That was what we called it, the really big honking church mega church strategy. So the two were going to plant. So there was $500,000. So our church planters were getting about $30,000. And these church planters were getting about $500,000. And I'm thinking, I know which team I'm signing up for. So we only planted eight of those $500,000 big honking mega church planting strategies. Here's why. The success rate of the ones that I funded and the success rate of the $500,000 ones were the same. I want you to let that sink in for just a second. I did my PhD dissertation analyzing the efficacy of church planting strategies in North America. And what I found is that everybody thought, every church planter, when you had the opportunity to write open comments about finances, every church planter thought they would have been more effective if they had more money. If they were part-time, or if they were unpaid volunteer, if they were just part-time, they would have been able to do this. If they were part-time, if they were just full-time, it would have worked. If they were full-time, if they just had full-time but startup funds. If they were full-time but startup funds, they just had a team. Everyone wanted more. And I get that. I always wanted more. But here's what we found. The amount of funding in no way correlated with the survivability of the church plant 4 years later. And that's kind of surprising. It's not surprising when we look to the principles of missiology and the teaching of the New Testament. Jesus says, don't carry a money bag, traveling bag, or sandals. Don't greet anyone along the road. Now, Jesus is not giving a theological, missiological treatise on church planting. He's talking about the initial spread of his gospel. But I think in there we can draw some of these principles that missiology helps us understand. Now, why does that matter to you? Well, this is the church planting breakout. We're going to talk about planting missional and biblical churches. And so this is an area of passion. What I want to say to you is this, is if you're planting a church, do not let finances be the determining factor with whether or not you plant a church. When I told you I planted my first church, I applied to my denomination for funding. my denomination turned me down. They sent me a nice letter, said, you know, that I love Jesus. They declined me. But the problem was this. My denomination did not call me to plant that church. God called me to plant that church. Furthermore, the church that was sending me believed God called me to plant that church. And so we went to Buffalo, New York, and moved into the inner city of Buffalo, New York. And I went and got a job. I blew insulation. And I ran a little insulation. And so my job was to climb up in attics, blow insulation while starting a church. I decided later to start doing some theological education on the weekends. I drove from Buffalo to Pittsburgh 4 hours a week, round trip to go to seminary, you know, each way uphill in the snow, all the joke, you know. But why did I do all that? Because God called me to plant church. What I want to say is this, is that if everyone's waiting reliantly for the funding to come, church planting never happens. Now, a lot of people, right now, I think we're getting all the church planting in America we can afford. Now we got to start getting a lot of church planting in America we can't afford. And so some of you, you may have been waiting, and I want to encourage you not to wait. I want to encourage you to go plant the church, go get a job, go start a church, and step out in faith to do that very thing. I think we need to open more lanes. I think of when I go to Walmart, which I try to avoid at all costs, but when I go to Walmart, I invariably go to the Walmart in my neighborhood, my city, and which I go on a Saturday. Don't go to Walmart on a Saturday, just as a general rule. And you know, you've seen the pic. Go to peopleofwalmart.com. There's always these great pictures of you know, people spotted at Walmart. And so I've submitted one, actually. A guy actually created this right front bumper out of duct tape instead of Bondo. He just duct taped the thing all up. So, oh, that's awesome. I had to put that on People at Walmart. So when you go to Walmart, though, there are, my Walmart has like 16 lanes. And they're all lined up there, and only one of them is open. And there's 16 people in that one lane. Of course, there's the self-checkout lane, but that never works. I'm sorry, if you're in the retail industry, fix the self-checkout. It's not a concept that's working. So I'm standing in the lane, and I'm thinking, this is crazy. I actually took a picture, put it on Twitter. I had a little bit of snark on Twitter. So I finally think to myself, what do I need to do is open more lanes? And it strikes me, this is what a lot of church planting looks like in the United States today. There's a lot of people waiting in a lane called funded vocational church planters, when God has not called us to wait for funded vocational church planters. For many of you, who's called you to plant a church, and then you are going to provide some of the income, other means, you're going to step out in faith and along the way. And I think that's what we see is this begin with radical reliance here, is that don't carry the money back, just step out. There's never be enough money for you to go. There'll never be enough people for you to send. Maybe your church needs to be involved in church planting. There's never going to be enough people for you to send as well. But if you think that way, even let's talk about as a church that's intentionally multiplying itself. I like to think of it as a church that that is born pregnant. That sounds strange, I know, but it comes from a very significant moment of literature and art in American history. It's a Star Trek episode, and in this Star Trek episode, there were these things called the Tribbles that were there. And the Tribbles were, this is the most famous episode of Star Trek ever, written by David Gerald. Wow, the fact that I know that's kind of a little creepy, isn't it? So the Tribbles kind of take over the Enterprise, and they eat all this grain. I won't go into all the details, probably went into too many details already. But they save the world from the Klingons, blah, blah, blah. But they keep multiplying. They can't stop multiplying. Everywhere they go, they multiply, which is what we want, right? We want churches multiplying everywhere. We want churches multiplying in Starbucks. We want churches multiplying in homes. We want churches multiplying in buildings. We want churches multiplying in hotels. And so Dr. McCoy rushes in and finally figures out how to stop these things from multiplying. And no one wants to kill them. They're cute little creatures. And says, but he comes in and says, Jim, here it is. And he holds it up and says, all you got to do is stop feeding them, and they'll be fine. They won't starve. But he said, I don't know all the detail, but stop feeding them. Here's why. Because they're born pregnant. See, it seems to me that in times of great movemental advance, churches were born pregnant. In times of spiritual drought, churches are born barren. And what I would say is, it seems to me that most churches are born barren today because they're afraid of sending out people and sending out resources to plant churches. Now, I get that. You know, we planted our church in Erie, Pennsylvania. We were running about 300 people or so after a couple of years. And we decided to plant two daughter churches, and I announced it. I announced it on Easter Sunday. We had this big Easter Sunday service, and so I announced that We are going to start two new churches. I had our leadership team on board, but afterwards I had someone come up to me and say, Pastor, we're not ready to start two new churches. We want to do two on one day, one day have twins. And so we're not ready to start two new churches. And I thought to myself, I have not prepared the people well. But what he said was very interesting. He says, we're too small and we're too young and we're too unprepared to plant a church. Now we're running 300 people at the time. You know, we have two worship teams that rotate because we have too many musicians. We have small groups all over town. We've got small groups meeting in the places where we're going to launch two churches, one in Harbor Creek and one in Meadville. So we've got all this going on here. And yet my people are thinking that we don't have enough. We need more here before we can send them there. Why? Because what happens is we've kind of convinced ourselves that it takes more than we have or more than we are to plant a church. There was a survey, and it's not a real or scientific survey, but I'm going to illustrate it. It was published in a magazine years ago called Interest Magazine. And what the survey did is, non-scientific, was ask, what's the right size to plant a church? Send out a daughter church. And here's what people said. They generally said, if they're running 100, they said 125. If they're running 1,000, they said 1,250. The answer was typically 25% larger than I am right now. And then I'll be ready to start church. Because when they get 25% larger, guess what? They say 25% larger from what I am right now. But we've got to move beyond. We've got to move to radical reliance in church planting. Now, the reason movements have been successful is they were radical and passionate. The Vineyard people thought they had something new and unique that people needed to see and understand. So they went out like crazy. The Baptists and the Methodists thought they had something new and unique. Pentecostals in the 20s, 30s, and again in the 50s thought they had something new and unique they thought the world needed to see. Now again, I'm talking as a sociologist here. Those were new and unique. Here's what I think. I think we all have something new. New life. People, they need this. And the urgency that drove them to plant churches should be found in the urgency that we have to plant churches as well. So planting churches is central to what the church is commanded to do. So number one, begin with radical reliance. Number two, bless the community. Bless the community. Look at verse 5. It says, whatever house you enter, first say peace to this household, which is an interesting tradition that was not uncommon in that day. Sort of, it's a way to say, I'm thankful and I bless you and ask God's blessing on you. If a son of peace is there, your peace will rest on him. But if not, it will return to you. Now, that's an interesting phrase. If a son of peace is there, people talk about a person of peace, and it's probably not what that's talking about here. A person of peace is the idea that someone like a Lydia is in a town that's waiting, and God is prepared to respond to the gospel, and she can connect you with other people. And I'm actually not against that phrase. It's just not probably what this is talking about. If a son of peace is there, does that mean a believer? Well, probably not this early stage, but maybe someone God's preparing for that. But long story short, people debate what this means. But here's what it, but notice it, peace to this household, and to speak that and to see the response that's there. Here's the thing. I think for church planting, we need to bless, love others, and leave the response to God. Now, a lot of ways we can bless the community. And this way is very specific. Peace to this household. That was a tradition of that first century Hellenistic Judaism to kind of pronounce a blessing. And I would say we can bless our community in lots of ways. I love Jeremiah chapter 29, verses 4 through 7. It says, this is what the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, says to all the exiles I deported from Jerusalem to Babylon. So here it is, right? This is what God is saying to the Jewish exiles. Build houses and live in them. Plant gardens and eat their produce. Give your daughters to men in marriage so that they may bear sons. And I'm sorry, take wives and have sons and daughters. Take wives for your sons and give your daughters and men to marriage so that they may bear sons and daughters. Multiply there, do not decrease. Seek the welfare of the city I have deported you to. Pray to the Lord on its behalf, for when it has prosperity, you will prosper. Now, again, not all the principles are going to be the same. This is an Old Testament principle of people in exile. But I like the focus here. I like the focus. And whenever you enter a house, say, peace to this household. And I like the focus here is that when you go to a city, settle in, live there, be a part of that. Listen, I want you to love the community that you are planting more than the people who've lived there longer than you. I got to tell you, I go nuts about this. I know more about Erie, Pennsylvania than any person in America. Probably any person here. I spent time at Chamber of Commerce. I spent time at the Historical Commission. I know, for example, that Erie, Pennsylvania has more bowling alleys per capita than any city in the country. It's true. So what did I do? I learned to bowl. Now, again, I know that seems odd. Or when I was in Buffalo, I know that when you live in Buffalo, the only thing you got going for you is the Buffalo Bills. Buffalo is economically depressed, poverty, crime where I live. I lived in there in the middle of the crack epidemic. There are drive-by shootings 2 houses down from us. We were robbed multiple occasions, but we loved the Buffalo Bills. I want you to know this. I know nothing about football. Absolutely nothing about football. I can't play Trivial Pursuit because every time it gets to sports, it goes bad. I had my boss, who's an Alabama fan, and I'm from New York, so I don't get any of this stuff. My boss is an Alabama fan. He says, let's go to an Alabama game. So I get in his car. We drive down to the middle of nowhere in Alabama, where there's a stadium that seats 8 million people. And we drive into, and it's like a whole town is formed around this. And he goes, and he got these, he scored us these special tickets for the Skybox. So I go into the Skybox, and I'm meeting people. And he, Tom introduced me to this guy. I said, hey, come meet this guy. And I shake his hand, and I said, and Tom introduced, this is Bart Starr. I said, well, hello, Mr. Starr, good to meet you. And I shake his hand. He has these big rings on his finger. I say, shake his hand, good to see you, Mr. Starr. And he walks away, and I say, Tom, now who is Bart Starr? And a few of you know what I'm talking about. Bart Starr, I guess, is some big football deal. I looked it up on Wikipedia very soon thereafter and found that he won some, that was his rings, or his Super Bowl rings and all that sort of stuff. I know nothing about football. But here's the thing. When I loved the people of Buffalo, New York, I learned to love a lot of what they loved. See, part of the thing is you've got to be a part of the community to love a community. See, I get, like we're in Columbus and Buckeyes, is that right? Woo! Is that just a random sound, or is that something related to the Buckeyes? Okay, okay. Here's the deal. I want you to hear this. This may be the hardest thing you ever hear at any conference ever. But if you move and you go start a church in Louisville, you got to root for Louisville. It's, no, I'm out. I quit the gospel. I'm done. I'm joining another religion. Why would you every day showcase that you are not of these people? Now, again, you can say, well, I can be a part of it as well. I get that. But here's what I would say. If you're going to plant a church, bless the community by engaging it as much as you can. Plant gardens. Eat their produce. Take wives, have sons, daughters. Take wives for your sons and give your daughters men in marriage. Seek the welfare of the city. I have deported you. Here's the thing I tell church planters. Unpack your bags. See, so I remember I was in Pennsylvania. We were listening to a introduction at a regional meeting of new workers in the area, and one of the people got up and said, hey, my name is so-and-so, and this was in Philadelphia, and we're from Texas. And the wife then spoke up, and the husband said that, and the wife then said, yes, we're from Texas, and we're glad to be here, but we're always going to be Texans in our heart. Well, they were actually Texans again about 8 months later. See, if you don't unpack your bags and love even the unlovable, again, living in the urban core in Buffalo, New York, and loving the people that God has sent to us who are on welfare, who are drug dealers, who are pimps, who are the second marriage I did, the first marriage in the city, but I did a marriage before when I was training in college, but the first marriage I did there was to a prostitute to her pimp. Both came to Christ, both were radically saved by the power of the gospel. She had 3 kids by 3 different men, none by him, but then they're living together. They both were changed by the power of the gospel. I married them, and it was a glorious, beautiful thing. We wept because God was glorified, God was honored. It was funny, 6 months later, they came to me, and they're both off drugs. He was working at a job, he's a very enterprising guy. To be a pimp, you gotta be an enterprising guy, it appears. And so, very enterprising guy. And so what happened, so then he comes to me, and they come to me, and they say, Pastor, we don't know how to tell you this, but this neighborhood is really dangerous. So I said, yeah, you were like the cause of that 6 months ago, just for the record. And so they said, we're moving away. We got to get away from this crime. And so they moved 30 minutes away. This was the story of our church life. People would get redeemed, saved, sober, and move away. But that's what we loved it. You know why? Because we unpacked our bags. People say, well, it's my dad, who's not a believer. My dad said, why would you move to Buffalo? Why Buffalo? He called it the armpit of New York. But because God has given us a heart and a burden for them. You know, John Knox said of Scotland, he said, give me Scotland or I die. If you're going to plant a church, you got to hear from the Lord to love these people. Then you got to love these people in such a way that say, you give me these people or I die. So I'm planting a church in Hendersonville right now. I love the people of Hendersonville. Now, I don't always understand the people. I understand the people of Buffalo better than I understand the people of Hendersonville. Because I grew up in the city. I grew up on Long Island in a very poor community and welfare. I grew up on public assistance. And so I understood the people. Now I'm in Hendersonville, which is an affluent, upper middle class community and in the South. And so I'm fixing to learn how to speak. And it's a whole different world. But you know why? I want to bless and I want to love this community. You do this part by your heart, but part by the actions of your church, is you can serve the community. For example, we're starting a church in a movie theater, but our movie theater, and that's sometimes awkward, you know, last Sunday, they're supposed to change the signs on top of the little marquees. You know, there's the marquee up front, but over the theater it says the movie is playing. So you're supposed to change the signs, a little digital ones, so it says Grace Church on our three theaters. We use three theaters, two for kids, one for worship service, and then one for, we use the party room for the nursery. And so sometimes they forget. So this week, church, you walk into theater one, it's Magic Mike. And so that's a little awkward. So I explained to the kids, oh no, it's a movie about a magician. You know, but we meet in a movie theater, so we're actually meeting in the town square. It's a suburban community, so it's kind of a fake town square. You know, they build these planned urban, new urbanism. I like the new urbanism feel. And so we've got the movie theater on one side, Barnes & Noble over here. Our visitor parking is in front of Victoria's Secret, which is a little awkward, but it's where you pull in. Over here, all the stores, and then there's the square in the middle with a fountain and all that sort of stuff, but it's where community events take place. Well, we actually do all the community events. There's some things that when there's something sponsored by the streets of Indian Lake, that's where we are. We are in charge of those events. So we do the fall music festival, and our church has a booth. We do Beats at the Streets. That's something we specifically put on. We do the Easter egg hunt, which is a fascinating thing. We bring in 2,000 eggs into this little square that's probably twice the size of this room. But imagine 2,000 eggs. It's really not an Easter egg hunt. It's basically we put up ropes and then children get to run and fall on top of the eggs that they find. But 1,000 kids come to that. And that's the number one place where we connect with the community and we meet people. We have all our people at Grace Church Church going around meeting people. Why? Because we're blessing and connecting with the community at the same time. Our ultimate goal is gospel proclamation, because as you saw earlier. Now, that leads to the third thing. Build relationships and settle in. Okay? So again, look, walking through this passage in Luke, verse 7, it says, remain in the same house, eating and drinking what they offer, for the worker is worthy of his wages. I told you I was going to get to finance in just a minute. Don't be moving from house to house. When you enter any town, they welcome you. Eat the things set before you. Now, get a picture here. Remain in the same house may give us the implication that peace to this household, if a son of peace is there, your peace will rest on him. May, but not certainly, give us the indication this combat, if this person is a Christian, they'll welcome you in and house you. May. As a matter of fact, that's what I would think it's saying. But it says, remain in the same house, eating and drinking. But look what it says. Don't be moving from house to house. Now, and this is key. If you're going to plant a church, you need to get rooted in the community where you're going to plant the church. Don't plant a church on remote control. A lot of people tried to plant a church in the city where we were in Buffalo, and they failed because they didn't want to live in the city. They want to say, well, I can live outside the city and not be there. No. I lived in the midst of the crime. I was a target of the crime. My wife was a target of the crime. But God had called us to be there, to love the people that were there. And the safest place you can be is in the center of God's will. And maybe that's not even true, because I don't know if safe is the right word. The right place you could be is in the center of God's will. But notice it says, when you enter any town and they welcome you, eat the things set before you. Now, this is a key thing. Now, part of this has to do with the coming admonition of eating the food of the Gentiles. Okay, so this is a part of the redemptive history, is a coming admonition to eat the food of the Gentiles, because the gospel is going to go forward to the Gentiles as well. But I think it's a bigger issue here, is that this is the place where if we're going to plant a church in a place, we need to reflect to some degree that place. I want you to hear this. The how of church planting is in many ways determined by the who, when, and where of culture. Let me say it again. The how of church planting is in many ways determined by the who, when, and where of culture. So someone comes to me and says, Ed, I'm going to plant a church. And I'll say, well, great, super. And I remember asking a guy one time, well, what kind of church are you going to plant? Because you could plant, you know, it's funny. You know, when I started church planting, you sort of just planted a church and it was a church. And, you know, now, you know, what kind of church are you going to plant? Well, I'm going to plant a purpose-driven, cell-based, moderately reformed, seeker-sensitive Methodist church. Okay, but if they go to a different conference, I'm going to plant a missional, incarnational community of Christ followers sent out on a mission of societal transformation, Presbyterian church. Different conferences, right? You're hanging a different crowd. But I asked one of my students, said, what kind of church are you going to plant? Is it going to be a house church? Is it going to be a what? And he said, and here's what he said. I was really proud of him. He said, I don't know. He was being smart when he said it, because he's like trying to make a point to me that I should know better. He said, I don't know. I don't know and love the people yet. I can't tell you that. See, when you take the time to know and love the people and then plant the church that would engage and reach the people that you know and love, that makes more sense. Too often what we do, church planters go to conferences, and I think conferences are awesome, but also dangerous. I was speaking a few years ago at, a couple years ago at Saddleback had a conference, and they were doing, and my session was on church planning. It wasn't a church planning conference, but my session was on church planning. And so I specifically addressed church planning, and there were a lot, I don't know, but here's what I said. All the speakers, there were nine of us who were speakers, and they didn't have breakouts, all main sessions. So the nine of us were speakers. All of us had one thing in common. All of us had planted a church, which was fascinating to me, that I'd be on a conference, every single person had planted a church or had started a church. But the other, with the exception of me, all other eight were at the church that they planted. So, you know, and you'd know the names. I was kind of, you know, it was the rock star celebrities of evangelicalism, and then me. It's like, you know, one of these things is not like the other. A little Sesame Street there for you. But what I said, I got up there, and I kind of said something maybe I shouldn't, but here's what I said. I said, pastors, I said, I want to caution you. You go to these conferences and you hear these pastors, you know, these guys get up. I heard one speaker say, one speaker, very prominent evangelical, very primary Christian leader. He said, you know, I don't know. We just went out and started this church, and I started preaching through Leviticus. 1,000 people came. You know, I'm like, really? Because I preach Leviticus, nobody comes. But you hear these things and these stories, and people get up and they tell these stories. Well, we just started this church, and 1,000 people started coming. We don't know, and now we're running 15,000 people, and we started 70 more churches. And you look at that, and I got to tell you, that's not what it looks like the vast majority of the time. Let me tell you, the typical church plant, I have the research, does not break 100 in attendance after 4 years. It's still running under 100 in attendance at 4 years. So I got up in my talk, and I was talking about church planting, and I said, let me just tell you, I'm at Saddleback, I'm speaking in the Saddleback Auditorium, all this big glass everywhere, sunshine, it's California, you know, everybody's singing, you know, California songs. I'm a New Yorker, so it seems it's very bright. So I get up and I say, listen, don't. I said, it's not a bad thing. You can't, you know, it's kind of like the building. I really love the building. So I'm just using an example. I love being at the conference. I'm thankful for Rick's ministry, and we're friends. I preached for all the services that Sunday at the church, so we're friends. Even after I said this, he let me preach all the services that Sunday. Here's what I said. I said, Pastor, I want to warn you of a danger. Planter, I want to warn you of a danger. This is not real. The nine speakers you're hearing, the campus you're on. I said, you drove off of Lake Forest Park, whatever that road is. You turned onto Saddleback Way, and you came up to a stoplight at the corner of Purpose Drive, and you turned right to come up into the parking. This is not normal. I said, if you are not careful, this will distract you. This will become for you ministry pornography. An unrealistic depiction of an experience you're never going to have that distracts you from the real and glorious thing. And the room looked at me, and then they weren't sure if it was funny or not, a nervous laugh. But it is and it isn't. Because I think it can become that very thing. If you want to plant a church, you're going to have to enter a town, set what they put before you, live there, live among them, love them, die to your expectations of them, love them enough to reach them for Christ and disciple them, and then a church will be birthed from and among them. But too many pastors go to too many teams go to a church planting conference, and they hear about how somebody planted a church, how somebody else planted a church, how somebody else planted a church, and they get like this model in their head. They fall in love with a model, and they lose focus on the mission. And what I would say is this, is too many pastors plant churches in their heads, not in their communities. You are not Tim Keller, living in New York City. You're not Rich Nathan, planting a church in Columbus. You're not Rick Warren in California. You're not Mark Driscoll. You're not the founding pastors of this church. So you've got to recognize that God calls you to a place. You've got to unpack your bags there. And here's the thing I want you to hear. You can pastor a church and not be a people person. In fact, you can pastor a church very successfully and be really grumpy I know some really grumpy pastors who are great preachers, and that will grow a really, really big church. You can't start a church if you don't love people, not willing to lay down your life for people, not willing to get to know people, and that's not always easy. That makes church people mad. Every Super Bowl, we host a party in my neighborhood, the Super Bowl party, and from this Super Bowl to last Super Bowl, we didn't have a church. This Super Bowl, we had a church, and so everyone in my church wants to plan a Super Bowl party. And I said to them, I'm having a Super Bowl party, you're not invited. All of my pagan neighbors come over. That's what I called them, by the way, when I welcome them. I like to welcome my pagan neighbors. No, I don't call them that. But for me, that's why I want to be with them. So again, you can get sucked into church life. I think better, again, is instead, when you enter town, then they welcome you, eat the things set before you, remain, listen, learn, love them in church planning. Here's one of the things we found. One of the things when you're a researcher, is you get these things. I've always wondered this. And so you get to ask, right? So you do a survey, and surveys are fun, you know, and everyone like believes and then disbelieves surveys. And so it's fun to argue about them and all sorts of stuff. So one of the things that we did a little survey of is when I was doing my PhD dissertation, I threw in a fun question. A lot of times researchers will throw in a fun question into a research sample. I do it regularly. The Christians get on my nerves question was intended to be a fun question. I didn't think it would be on CNN. And so here's the question I threw in to my PhD dissertation. I asked how far away the church plant was from the wife's parents' home. Why would you do such a thing? Here's why. Because the farther it was away from the wife's parents' home, the more likely it was the church planter would quit. Isn't that interesting? Now, why is such a thing? Now, it's not the wife's fault. I just picked the wife because the sample we had would fit well in that with that description. Here's one of the reasons why. You know, we have a church planting. We have four pastors at our church plant right now, pastor elders, and one of them was going back to visit their wife's parents' home, and they said this to me, yeah, we're going to go home for the weekend. And I explained, no, this is home now. This is home now. See, one of the greatest challenges for any of us is to live on mission where we are. And that means your home church is the church that you're planting, not the church that you came from. Your home place is where you're planting, not the place that you came from. So it's essential to build relationships and settle in. Let me get to number four, and then we're going to have questions. Meet needs and serve people. Meet needs and serve people. It says, verse 9, heal the sick who they are. Heal the sick. I love that. I love that. Now again, some of you are like, oh, we don't believe to heal sick anymore. Well, okay, first, God still does heal, I think, and we should pray and ask for healing and then leave the results to God. But I think the bigger issue, healing sick is almost always a picture in the New Testament of doing God's care for those who are hurting, widows, orphans, those who are sick. And so ultimately our job is, I love this. I love the picture that Jesus gives. In Luke chapter 4, verse 18, Jesus says, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to set free the oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. And so where Jesus came to serve. Jesus came serving the hurting. He lists in here the poor, the captives, the blind, the oppressed. He's going to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor, building on this whole Old Testament promise of the year of the Lord. So in Luke 4:18, Jesus says he came to serve, but the same Jesus in the same gospel says in Luke 19:10, I came to seek and save those who are lost. Jesus came to serve and to save if, as I proposed in our last session, we are called to join Jesus on his mission. We join in Jesus' mission. He's serving and saving a lost and hurting world. We join in his mission. So churches should be engaged in serving the hurting. Now say why? People ask why. Well, here's the thing. The center of the mission is always gospel proclamation. But flowing from and being a part of that mission is gospel demonstration. That by living out the implications of the gospel, we are ambassadors. We don't just tell good news, we be, do, and tell good news. We are good news. We do good things, and then we tell good news in the midst of that. Now it's very tempting at this point to use a St. Francis of Assisi line. You maybe have heard this before. It says, preach the gospel. We preach the gospel at all times, when necessary, use words. Have you heard that before? Lots of you. All right. Here it is. Preach the gospel at all times when necessary. Use words. Only two problems with it. Number one, he never said it. Number two, it's not biblical. Other than that, fine to use it anytime you want to. He never said it. 100 years after his death is the first crediting of him saying it. And he wouldn't have said it. He was part of a preaching order. He thought that he preached. That's what he did. But more importantly, it's not biblical because it's like saying feed the hungry at all times when necessary, use food. No, I mean, the gospel is what people need to hear. So I want you to hear is that we do show the love of Christ as we share the love of Christ. And part of your church needs to be known for, it will hurt you if you get a bad reputation. It can be an opportunity for the gospel advance if you get a good reputation. Let me share you a quick story. I was the interim pastor of a church that earned a very bad reputation in its town. It had been racked with conflict, national conflict. It made national news. It was in AP nationally. What happened was, is the group of people got mad at the pastor. The pastor got mad at the group of people. The people sued the church over their grievances in a court. The church excommunicated them for suing the church. The church actually failed in its first vote by 7 votes to excommunicate them. So then they had a subsequent vote where they changed the rules of the vote so that the people who were being excommunicated couldn't vote because if you're being tried, you're not supposed to be on the jury, or I forget the exact words. And so then the second time they voted them out, so they excommunicated them. That was on Mother's Day. So this now, at this point, this has been on the news now, the local paper, front page of the paper 5 times on the nightly news TV, on the evening news broadcast locally in Nashville. So the church just destroys its reputation. On Mother's Day, this all comes down. I've watched the video of the Mother's Day service. On Mother's Day, this all comes down, and people are screaming, you lie, you liar. And it's like all this, singing, "We Shall Overcome," joining hands. I mean, really gets bad. Cops are called, the whole nine yards. And this is the church, right? So eventually the pastor leaves after those people are excommunicated, the church has declined. It has a 3,000-seat auditorium, so substantially larger than this, 3,000-seat auditorium, and there's 750 people left in 2 services, one traditional, one contemporary, because they don't get along. And so that makes sense, put them in a room with 300 people in a room with 3,000 seats. And pastor eventually leaves, and I had just finished up an interim, and so they call me and they say, "Ed, would you be the interim of our church?" And I was like, "Yeah, no way. Are you people nuts?" And the obvious answer was yes. I did think they were nuts. And so I said, "No way." And so my wife rebukes me, and she does it a lot. And she says, "Have you prayed about this? Have you really prayed about if the Lord would have you? This church is hurting, and you could minister to them." And I said, "Jezebel," that's my nickname for her. Particularly at situations like this. She's trying to get me to do something I don't want to do. I said, "Jezebel, these people are crazy. I mean, they're all over the news. They're like killing each other." And she says, "Yes, and you should at least go and pray." Okay. So I go to the church and I go to preach 1 time. And Donna comes with me and we bring our kids and we sit there and I preach both services, traditional and contemporary. And she's looking at me the whole time, kind of looking at me, "You praying?" She kind of gave me that look. And so afterwards we go to lunch and she says, "You really probably should help these people." "Jezebel." So we pray about it. And the church is just about to go into bankruptcy. It's got millions of dollars in debt, tens of millions of dollars in debt. Can't afford it. Leaks in the building. They've got parts of the building shut off. And so, we pray about it together. Don and I pray through, believe, okay, the Lord's calling us to do this. So I become the interim pastor of this church. Now, they can't afford me. So they can't afford a lot of their staff. So I actually had, I'm going to come, but the first thing I got to do is I got to eliminate 26 staff positions. The fact that you could eliminate 26 staff positions should be a signal to you that they were overstaffed. And so I eliminated 3 full-time positions and 23 part-time positions, including my own was a part-time position. I said, you can't pay me, you can't pay anybody, you're about to go into bankruptcy. And so I asked the 23 part-time people to stay as volunteers, 19 of them did. We were paying an orchestra librarian in a church of 700 people. Yeah, I remember it was thousands not that long ago. And so here's the thing. The church had a terrible reputation. Terrible. Everyone in the community, if you went door to door in the community, it's like, "Oh, you're the crazy people at that church." I said, "Yep, that's us." So we started talking in our church. We created a new phrase. We're going to earn a new reputation for showing and sharing the love of Jesus. We'd say it over and over again. We're going to earn a new reputation for showing and sharing the love of Jesus. And I thought we're going to do it. I mean, I'd have them say it Sunday morning. And so we started to see the church turn around, and it started to grow. We grew at maybe 900 in a few months. And the news came back. One of the news stations came back and said, just do it. Where is that now? And one of our folks got on the camera and said, yeah, we're starting a new reputation for showing and sharing the love of Jesus. And that got on the news. We were like, yes, yes, yes. And it became news. It made the front page of the local section of the paper that this church, Two Rivers is the name of the church, is got a new direction, a new focus, is coming back. But still, it was pretty bad reputation. And then something I wouldn't wish on anybody happened. There was a great flood that hit Nashville. It was the Great Nashville Flood. It was a 1,000-year flood. No, we haven't seen anything like it before in history. I'm living there, and all of a sudden, the interstate is underwater. Houses were floating down the interstate. Dozens of people died during this flood. It didn't get a lot of national news coverage. A balloon boy got more national news coverage than this did. But it was a very, very big deal, because what happened is happened in phases. It happened in phases because of a dam and the way it releases water. It got filled, then it had to release, and it flooded downtown and it flooded where we were. So our church was right next to it. If you've been to Nashville, the church is it's the mega church right across the street from Opryland Hotel and Resort. You can't miss it. It's just gigantic. It's right there. You drive by it. Many of you know what I'm talking about. It's right there. And so all of a sudden, the dam up the river needs to, you can't overtop a dam or lose its stability. So the Corps of Engineers has to open the dam. So they open the dam. All the water comes down. It floods out of the Cumberland. It floods and destroys the Opryland Hotel and Resort. And all of a sudden, the river on the other side of us. But we find out at the time, the church is called Two Rivers. And there's a reason it's called Two Rivers. One's over here, one's over here. Both of them flood their banks. But we found out what we didn't know before. Two Rivers, our church, was on a hill. And you don't know these things until all of a sudden you're in an island. Well, I'm a person who doesn't believe. So it started raining Saturday, and rained and rained and rained. I don't believe in canceling church. I never cancel church. I don't believe in it, fundamentally opposed to it. I know that's weird, but I figure if you can't make it, don't come. If someone comes, they can pray, they can sing, they can study the Word of God. If I can't make it, right. But my wife, Jezebel, disagrees with this policy. And so that morning is raining and raining, and all these churches start canceling church because, we can't, there's floods here and floods there. I'm like, we're not going to cancel. So I drive down. My wife says, I am not going to church with you today. And so I drive down to there, and, this time we have about 900 people, and about 90 people show up. So we do the first service with like 45 people, and everything's going fine. And then the second service starts, and all of a sudden something blows up outside. The electricity goes out in the building. And so we go outside, and we see that the road we came in on, it's not quite an interstate, but it's like an interstate. It's a state interstate. The road we come in on is now underwater. It wasn't underwater when I drove on it just 2 hours ago, but now it's underwater. So I call my wife, and her first words are, how's it working for you now, not canceling church? And making her sound terrible. She's awesome. But it was just a little running joke we had. So we got out of there, and we had to get out. And the river kept rising. Opryland was flooded. Matter of fact, they had to start evacuating their people and busing them in, some to our church and other places. But then what happened was it just broke loose. People died. The whole community behind our church was destroyed. Anderson Cooper would come and tour the area, and CNN would cover it, and the Grand Ole Opry was flooded, and Opryland was $200 million. The mall, all this is right within distance of our church, so our church is on the news, and we can't get to it because it's all flooded. But 3 days later, we were able to get to it. But we have been spending the last 3 or 4 months as a church talking about building a new reputation for showing and sharing the love of Jesus. We had actually, on Saturday of the flood, been out with our yellow t-shirts doing what we called Servolution. We stole the name from a friend. But we had Servolution t-shirts. My family was cleaning a public school, ministering there in the name of Christ. And so we did all these things. And then all of a sudden, it kept raining that day when we were cleaning the school. We didn't know that school would be underwater the next day. But all of a sudden, the church had the opportunity to serve others in a way that it had never done before. And it became really weird really fast, because all of a sudden, I mean, we were the only building, large building around. So we were hosting meetings of Opryland Resort. We got a phone call. A school was destroyed. They said, can we come meet in your church? We said, sure. I mean, so we moved a school in. The government moved in. The government relief offices moved in, and we were running them out of our church. And we had all this sort of stuff. Then we get the weirdest call of all. We get a phone call from the Grand Old Opry. And they said, we've been destroyed. We've got some shows with nowhere to go. Could we meet and have the Opry? It's broadcast uninterrupted for decades. Could we broadcast the Opry from your church? This creates a bit of a moral crisis for me because I believe God uses any form of music for his glory and honor, except country western. So, no, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. But I will tell you, I've been to the Grand Ole Opry, and you got to get little Jimmy Dickens up there, start making his little jokes. I don't want those little jokes at my church. And so we had a little chat, and we said yes. So they moved in, and I got to have a little bit of say in who came that night. And so, matter of fact, it turned out to be Ricky Skaggs, who became a friend, and he just loves Jesus. He gets up, he's talking about, I just want to thank this church, and Ed Stetcher, he's a friend of mine, you got to come to this church, and you know, he's like calling on, of course, all of them live somewhere far away. You know, half the audience is Japanese, and they're just sitting there, have no idea, but you know, Ricky, and then Ricky plays bluegrass, and they're all smiling. But here's the thing. We wore all those shirts every day for the next week. I took a week off of work because, you know, it's not my job, but I took a week off week work as a volunteer, took my vacation week, and we cleaned out houses. I shared the gospel. We ministered to people who were hurting, who lost everything. We did it every day for a week. Our church gathered. We gathered together for prayer. We'd go out again. For Samaritan's Purse moved their headquarters into our church, worked out there. Our parking lot was filled with water bottles and stuff for kids, and people come by. And what happened is we started going to the neighborhoods, and we went in the neighborhoods, and people would see us coming. They'd see the shirts, and they got dirtier and dirtier. And they began to know, oh, that's the church that's helping us, and that's the church that's serving us. And I got to tell you that in those few moments, those words changed. Before, we were the church full of crazy people. And then we were the church that was serving them because we loved them, because we cared for them. And it was interesting. The flood happened the week before Mother's Day. And it was Mother's Day was the first worship service we had after the flood. I'm wearing my shirt. We're all wearing our yellow muddy shirts. We actually, before church, had to go out and move some water pallets and things of that sort so people could get and people could continue to be okay. And then we came into church. And in the middle of the service, we began to talk about what God had done. Now, I wouldn't wish this flood on anyone, but God had been preparing our church to build a new reputation for showing and sharing the love of Jesus. God had been preparing our church because we're building a new reputation. At this moment, our church, I mean, the day before the flood, we were out serving our community in the name of Jesus, and then the flood came, and I said at that moment, and I'm up there just preaching, and I said, we remember a Mother's Day not that long ago when this church was known for something else, but this Mother's Day will be the Mother's Day that we remember. The Mother's Day we were covered in mud when we're serving people in the name of Jesus. We were seeing several people already commit their lives to Christ. This will be the Mother's Day that we remember. And we wept together. And we continue to serve. And that church has continued on its path of recovery. See, I think heal the sick who are there. Minister to those around you. You can't fix everything, and churches shouldn't try to, but we can help our people to engage. The center of the mission is gospel proclamation, but flowing from that mission is gospel demonstration, and we're called to engage in those things. Fifth and finally, announce the kingdom. Announce the kingdom. It says in the last part of the verse, it says, and tell them the kingdom of God has come near you. I love that. And tell them the kingdom of God has come near you. When Jesus tells people to do evangelism, he tells them to announce the kingdom of God. When we tell people to evangelism, we tell them to use a pickup line. Hey, if you were to die today, do you know for sure whether you go to heaven or hell? And what I would say to you is, I think that question can be okay. We did a survey to see if people were asking that question. They really weren't. But what I would say is, it's more than simply, hey, he'll forgive you your sins, pray Jesus, receive him into your heart, and that's it. It's the kingdom of God has come near. Repent. Jesus says in Matthew 4:17, because the kingdom of heaven has come near. So we call people to repentance. That's the gospel message, the full proclamation of that gospel message. So here's the deal. You can actually build a church on a lot of other things than the gospel and the kingdom. You can build it on being better than the other churches in town. You can do it on being more contemporary than the church in town, or more charismatic than the church in town, or more reformed than the other churches in town, or more house church based than the other churches in town. And what you will gather up is customers of the way that you do church. But if instead you plant a church with an intentional desire to engage lostness and lost people, you'll announce the kingdom. I really try to push pastors and church planners on this, that your job is not to go and to rearrange sheep. Your job is to plant a church that reaches people far from God, causes them to hear the good news of the gospel so they can be born again by grace and through faith, and their lives changed. Now, let me give you some statistics that say why this is not always happening. Again, we did the study. It's in Viral Churches, a book that Warren Bird and I wrote. It's the largest study ever done on North American church planting. And we wanted to find what was, matter of fact, it was Leadership Network sponsored. Leadership Network is this kind of well-known Christian leadership organization. Bob Buford was a very successful cable businessman. And then he gave all this money to start Leadership Network. And they get these rich donors and they give all this money. And one of these donors wanted to know, who's getting it done in church planting? And that was his question. His question, my work assignments, I was hired to answer the question, who's getting it done in church planting? And so we tried to pick a little more scientific methodology than that. But I put together a 400-page report. We read every doctoral dissertation and every book on the subject published in the English language from 1952 forward. Our team did. We had 24 people working on our team for 8 months. We surveyed every leader of every evangelical denomination, and then we went to the main lines, the Pentecostals, the traditionally African-American. We talked to every denomination that was engaged that would have somebody to talk to. We talked to key church planting churches. We talked to movement leaders. We talked to network leaders all along the way. And here's what we found. We found a lot of really cool things, good things. We also found that most church planting was mostly not converts. Okay, sorry for the double there. But most church planting was mostly not converts. But in the ones that were more converts than not, they had that from the beginning in their DNA. Too many, church planting is kind of cool right now. And I'm glad you're here. I mean, if we did a breakout in church planting 20 years ago, it would be the people here who couldn't get other jobs or get into other seminars. But now church planting is an amazing thing. I speak sometimes at this thing called the Exponential Conference in Orlando. I guess I keynoted it for the last 6 years. And when I started 6 years ago, there was 500 people there. Now there are 5,000 people there. I call it Church Plantapalooza now. What I would say to you is that church planting has become a hot thing, but evangelistic church planting still hasn't risen to the level where it needs to be. So as you go, I would encourage you now, but let me show you some let me share some factors that do it. So churches that intentionally plan evangelistic events were statistically more likely to have converts than those that didn't. Churches that, for example, engage community with serving events were statistically more likely to have, at what we call a statistically significant level, were more likely to have. There's actually a list of 18 factors in planning viral churches that lists 18 factors that churches did that led to higher evangelistic conversion rates. They were correlated with higher evangelistic conversion rates in their results. So my encouragement to you is this: is church planting is hard work. I don't think, this may sound weird to you, I don't think it's as hard as church revitalization. I think church revitalization is harder work. Pastoring's not harder work. Okay, so I'm talking about three categories here. Pastoring is the ongoing leadership of a congregation. Church revitalization is turning a declining church around. And church planting is starting a new church. I think pastoring, my experience has been, I've done all three, is probably the easier of the three. Church revitalization is the harder of the three, but church planting is still a challenging thing. If you plant a church today, 4 years from now, statistically, here's what will happen. There'll be three groups of people 4 years from now. A third of you will no longer be in church planting. Your church will have ceased to exist, will have failed. So a third of the church plants fail within 4 years. There's a number going around, 80% of new churches fail within the first year. That's not a real number. That's an advertising number. I actually know the guy who does it. He advertised it, come to my seminar, 80% of church plants fail, come to my seminar and you won't fail. We really make up a lot of bad statistics in Christianity. Those are not helpful statistics. I wrote an article called Curing Christian Stats Abuse in Christianity Today. It was based on an earlier thing called Evangelicals Behaving Badly with Statistics. When you convince yourself that things are impossible and undoable, it hurts you. For example, have you heard the stat that 94% of evangelical youth drop out of church after high school, never return? How many of you heard that stat? Okay. How many of you heard it at 86%? Raise your hand there. More of you heard it at 86%. Okay. Okay, that's not true. Nowhere close to that. It's not even a majority of evangelical users. A majority of Protestant church-going attendees who attend church for at least a year between in their freshman to senior year, drop out for at least a year between the ages of 18 to 22. About half of them return. But no, there's not among evangelicals as much. But we say these stats and people believe them, and it's bad because what it teaches students is that you're going to go to college and you're going to see how much a bunch of bunk this is because all your other friends saw it and they left. And that's not what really happens. You know that in your church. If you've got a vibrant evangelical student ministry, you know that they're not dropping out at that rate. Well, same thing about church planting. So, but there is a drop-off rate. So here's a third are going to cease to exist. Okay, a third are going to be struggling. They're not going to be yet self-supporting, yet to mission status. And then a third are going to be more vibrant congregations that are self-supporting, self-governing, self-propagating, and moving on together. That's kind of where it's going to be as you look at it from a statistical perspective. I will tell you that we looked at what are the factors, the statistically significant factors, that correlate with higher attendance, higher baptisms, and higher survivability, and evangelistic intentionality expressed in about 10, 12 different ways were key to those things along the way. Now, I could keep going, but I need to open it up for Q&A, and I tried to make this one a little more statistical and a little more analytical. So let's open up for Q&A. There are microphones here and here, so you're going to have to come up to the microphone right here. I don't think we have anyone running around, but if you'll head this way, take any question about church planning you'd like to address, and we'll jump in. Come on over here, sir.
Yeah, I just had a quick question. You were talking about learning to love what the people in your community loved. I really dig that idea, but I was just wondering if you had some practical ideas on how to get that happening in your church.
Yeah. I dig the fact that you use the word dig. That is really cool. I think one of the things, too, is that look at what Jesus did. Jesus spent time with children. Jesus told stories of the culture. Jesus gave examples from the culture. What I try to do is I get a history book. I get a context book. I try to figure out what... I actually have a whole chapter in Breaking the Missional Code called Engaging, Knowing and Engaging Your Community. It's one of the most important things. Is I have an intentional 20-step process that I encourage pastors to. You can actually find it online. If you look up, just Google Stetzer Engaging a Community. I've got a 20-step process. It's a little formulaic, but you don't have to do all 20, but it gives you a series of ideas. So, for example, when I move into a town and I'm going to plant a church, I want to meet the key people who love the community. So I go to the school, the school district leaders. I go to the city leaders. I sometimes talk to the radio station hosts, and I want to know, tell me about, what do I need to know about this city that I don't know about this city? And then what I do is I talk to other church leaders, even people that are very different than me, even people that I wouldn't even consider within the realm of Orthodox Christianity. I want to know, what do they know about this community? What's going on? Then I talk to the Christian leaders. And then what I do is I spend a lot of time with people, and I want to listen to their hearts, because the people of the inner city Buffalo are very different than the people of Hendersonville, Tennessee, where I'm meeting with today. So just last week I met for lunch with two of the men from my church, and that we're starting a new ministry called Life Interrupted. These are very successful businessmen. We live in a very successful area. Very successful businessmen whose lives have been interrupted. Now they're 55 years old, and they're unemployed, and they're making the income they made 25 years ago. And so now, and we did it. We asked on Sunday, said, "How many of you like to be a part of a group that talks about some of these issues?" And we had seven other people sign up. I didn't know this was an issue. This would not be an issue in Buffalo, New York. Nobody was set back in Buffalo, New York. We never were up in Buffalo, New York. So, but to know and to sit with them and to feel their hurt. Help me to understand and love them more deeply. So part of it's a process of knowing and getting engaged with people along the way. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I was thinking that important thing might be getting people in the community to end up being the leaders in the church. What kind of goals do you set in your church planning for raising up people from the community, maybe lay people into staff or higher levels of leadership? Or do you bring all staff from with you when you plant a church?
Let me say, it was kind of like, let me break it in two parts. People ask, what about team church planning? I believe you should never plant a church without a team. But I've never had a team till this time. I've never had a team when I showed up to plant a church. The team is already there. They're, I don't even like to use the word lay people, but they're God's ordinary people who are already there in town. So every time I planted a church, we had a team of 25, 30 people, and we were in this together, but there are people who were not believers perhaps 6 months ago. Some of them were existing believers who want to be part of the church plant. But I believe that the most important place to raise up leaders is to raise up leaders from the harvest. We see people redeemed by the power of the gospel, raised up, and become leaders in the church. And so one of the things right now at our church we're doing is I meet every Friday for lunch with our pastoral apprentice team. And I have three pastoral apprentices that are people in our church. One works for Verizon, one works for AT&T, rather ironic. And then the third one works in an insurance company. And so they take Wednesdays downtown for lunch. We work on the sermons, and they're part of our pastoral apprentice program. And they signed up two months ago. And the plan is that 10 months from now, they'll be sent out of our church. So, probably as planters, or have a pastoral role in our church. So we want to raise up people from within our congregation. However, I wouldn't be averse to hiring somebody from the outside when appropriate. But I'm more interested in raising up people who share DNA. And then I do believe in theological education. You know, I have lots of seminary degrees. But I believe that the best way to earn seminary education is on the go, is in the ministry, is in the trenches. That's how I've earned all my degrees, while I was in the trenches doing the ministry. And so I think that's a better way to do it. So we're going to, these guys that we're raising up, they're all going to be taking some additional training, but we believe we have a responsibility to raise them up locally. But at the same time, I don't have a problem bringing people outside. My preference would be inside, that we develop locally. Yes, sir.
We didn't get to have a chance to ask too many questions the last session, but I think it kind of translates when you're church planning. How do you get people to go from passive listeners, and you had referenced that, and we've set up these audiences, and people not having time. Are there other practical tips you can think of to help people, or what you can do to help people go from a passive listener to someone who's committed to living the Christian faith, with both within the church and in their workplaces?
Yeah. I think part of it is teaching. And in a gathered time with the instruction there, helping people to understand who they are in Christ, their identity, and because of their identity, their the opportunities and the way they live and their responsibilities as a kingdom citizen. But I think part of it is that this is not going to happen in a large group setting. I think strategically, churches need to find a way to strategically move people from sitting in rows, particularly those churches that's the main point of entry, people from sitting in rows to sitting in circles. But then those circles need to be a place where we're unafraid to do Hebrews 10:24, to provoke one another to love and good deeds. And I think that means creating a culture where we say to one another, man, how are you serving? And I know that's hard, because right now we're afraid. We don't want to offend people. I think that believers who are in community together can, should, and must turn to one another and say, so how are you serving? You know, man, can I help you find a place to serve? And so it's creating a culture of expectation. I think we've created a culture of passivity. And so I think that we have to begin to push the other direction. I think part of the reason, I'm going to talk about this in my next session, part of the reason is most pastors and house church leaders like people reliant on them. I really think part of it's us. We like them being passive spectators, because it makes us feel needed. And I love it when people come to me and say, Ed, I could never teach the Bible. Like, I could never understand that passage until you preach it. I love that. It's wrong, but I love the complete necessity and reliance upon me. But I have to push against it, because it's my human nature. I want to be, see the whole religious hierarchy? I want to be the religious hierarchy, because then I'm empowered, I'm valued, I'm important, I'm special. But it kills everybody. Listen, when you, as leaders, when you do for people what God has called them to do, everybody gets hurt, and the mission of God's hindered. And so it hurts you, it hurts them along the way. So what I would say is, the biggest thing I would say is, there's a biblical teaching element, but there's a cultural element. You have to have a culture. When you go to other places in the world, in fact, you can read a book on this. David Hesselgrave wrote a book called Dynamic Religious Movements, and looked at, not all Christian movements, but there is a cultural expectation that you will do something. Now, it's kind of weird. You know, why do Mormons go spend a year on mission? There's no requirement that a Mormon spend a year on mission. You don't have to do that. But almost every Mormon does. Why? Because there's a cultural requirement to do so. I want to encourage Christians, genuine biblical Christians, to live a life on mission. Not because there's some sort of written requirement, but because we are provoking one another to love and good deeds, holding each other accountable for that, and looking each other in the eye and saying, how are you serving? And I think that's a shift, because right now the normal Christian life, make a little play on words, the normal Christian life is passivity, not activity, and that's going to have the cycle broken. I think Xenos has done, has led in some challenging ways for us to think about that, but I think we all have a way to go. Here's the thing, the majority of people, the 7,000 churches we studied for this one project, The majority of people in the majority of churches are unengaged in meaningful ministry and mission. They're doing nothing. They're showing up for the show. They're not involved in the serve. The majority of people in the majority of churches. So I think, again, biblical teaching, cultural positive, I don't know how to use the word, provoking to love and good deeds. Yeah, what I'd say. Thanks. Right behind you. Go ahead. I like how you guys like write your questions down. You bring them up. It's so serious. I like it.
You mentioned after 4 years, a third would be failing, a third would be struggling, and then a third would be vibrant. And I was wondering if you could go into some details of the statistics. What are those factors that the latter third would do?
Yeah. What we did is we did a study. I'm going right over to you. I'm going to take something out of my bag. We did a study of over 1,000 churches to see their survivability and their health after 4 years. We had 12 denominations participate, Pentecostals, Presbyterians, Baptists, non-denominational, things of that sort. We actually compared them to one another. Now, I never released that, but I told them individually how they did. And some of them really liked me. Some, well, not so much. Because one of the things that the donor asked me to do is say who's getting it done, who's not getting it done, and you know, so I did, but we didn't release that part. We only released the good things, survivability and health. And so what we did is we did some analysis to ask the question, what things, activities, actions, other things took place that would make more likely the growth or the decline of a church plant. Now, these are statistics. These statistics they're not the answer to everything, but they do tell you something that when these churches did these things. So last week I preached at chapel at Assemblies of God headquarters and talked about this because Assemblies of God church planters do very well in evangelism. So, all right, here we go. All right. And by the way, this is, if you go to my blog at edstetzer.com and you Google, or not Google, use my search button and you look up church planting research, you can find this. Here were the statistically significant factors that led to higher attendance. A meeting in a school for the first year, meeting in a theater for subsequent years, mailing invitations to services, programs, events, conducting new members classes, using a church covenant signed by new members, starting at least one daughter church within 3 years, having a proactive stewardship development plan enabling church to be financially self-sufficient. Let's see, I'm skipping through some just along the way here. Conducting block parties or special events, delegating leadership roles, being assessed prior to church planting. Along the way. So those are some of the things that were higher attendance, higher baptisms. Now, not all the traditions in our study were credo Baptists. My church is a credo Baptist church. We baptize people after they believe. There were paedo Baptists. And so for the paedo Baptists who baptize infants, we ask them to report conversions. So these are conversions, or in our case, a conversion leading to baptisms. Number one factor was engaging in ministry evangelism, starting at least one daughter church was number two. Other things were special events, it's training, being assessed again, assessment. Now, here's the thing. The one thing I thought was most interesting was, I actually went through and I've done training on this in a lot of different places, was the four things that led to the highest survivability were interesting to me. Let me see if I can find that real quick. The number one thing that related to survivability was having realistic expectations of the church plant. Because a lot of people hear church planting and think, I'm going to go start a church and 1,000 people are going to come. And so they quit because they won't be able to make it through. So, but all that's available to you. I give all my stuff, I try to give away. So go to edstetzer.com, search church planting research presentations. Go ahead. I think this might be the last question. Go ahead.
Well, thanks again, Ed, for your insights. And my question would be in regards to your life group format. When we entrust people, like the lay people, to teach the Bible and the great responsibility that comes with that, how do you typically train people to lead, to train your church in knowing the Word and towards maturity and completeness in Christ?
Yeah. We want to push as many functions to the extremity as so that the extremity becomes more the body. So in other words, we want to say this public point of gathering is not our church, part of our church. But we want people to see, you know, the cliches of church of small groups. So we want them to exercise teaching, the Lord's Supper, you know, the so the ordinances, all that in the life of our church. So what we do is we have training times. We have twice a year kind of in-depth training times for our life group leaders. And then we have a monthly training gathering as well. And then our life group coordinator is consistently in touch, reading books, helping people to kind of do their own life development plan as well as they kind of move forward together. Thank you for the chance to share with you again. We'll have a good lunch and we'll see you a little later on.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.